Well, it is a great pleasure for my latest Nostalgia interview to be Andy Richards. This time, all the audio version, because of course we met for Kent Film Club.
Of course.
Where you revealed not your four favourite films, they may have been the four favourite films when you chose them, but then of course afterwards you said, actually, what about Scorsese?
Yeah, I want to come back and do a gangster special with you maybe one day. But no, it was really fun. It was really fun, and I do like kind of stopping and reminiscing a little bit from time to time, because sometimes we don't do that enough, I don't think.
Well, and of course, you're the channel director here at KMTV, where I've had the great pleasure to come on a regular basis for the last few years. So what we're going to do is sort of do a bit of going backwards and a bit of going forwards, reflecting forwards, looking to see what the future might have in store. But do you want to say a little bit first, Andy, about your background? Because am I right in thinking that you were born on one of the Channel Islands?
That's right. So I was born in Guernsey in 1982, so in the 80s in Guernsey, and I grew up there. I lived there for the first kind of 30 years of my life, and then I moved over to the UK, gosh, yes, 12 years ago. So no, I'm very much a Channel Islander, born and bred, and very proud to be.
Yeah, and I think sometimes with Michael Hughes, who I interviewed a long time ago on this, is from Jersey. And also interviewing someone who grew up on the Isle of Man, Anthony Manning. Interesting that sometimes when you're born in a place that maybe has limited facilities by way of, for example, cinemas, that actually it makes you all the more hungry to do those things because you can't take them for granted. You have to go literally the extra mile or cross the water in the extra mile to do them. Was that kind of your experience?
Absolutely. So, yeah, starting to talking about film again, yeah, it was huge. It was really challenging. So Guernsey's got a population of about 65,000 people. It's increased a little bit since the 80s, but it's a really kind of tight-knit community, and Guernsey people try their best to get the best things in life over to the island, but cinema was always very difficult. They had one big screen at Beausejour Leisure Centre, and it often got films a little bit later than in the UK, but it was always a thrill to go and see a film. Their first film I ever saw there was E.T. I'll always remember that. And then a hotel built three screens called the Mallard. I think it's still there. And they got three quite small screens, maybe 50 to 100 seats in each. But again, you didn't often get all the great films. But one thing that we did have, which was almost a salvation to film lovers in Guernsey, was a really good blockbuster. And I laugh when I talk to all the students that I work with now when they ask what blockbuster is, and getting their head round what video rentals and DVD rentals and game rentals as well. And so I loved going to Blockbuster so much that I got a job there when I was 18. And I worked at Blockbuster throughout university as well when I came over to the UK, but also there. And you got free rentals, so you could just watch whatever you liked all the time. And I worked there through a period of when DVDs were really starting to take off. And I always ask this question, I don't know if I've asked you this question before, maybe I have, but which film do you think was the first time there were more DVDs for than videotapes? So you could, when you come in, you can either get a videotape or a DVD. There was a film that they produced more DVDs for us to rent than tapes.
I'm going to guess, so this would have been around 2000-ish, I would imagine.
Something like that, yeah.
So probably something like American Beauty or Fight Club.
Not bad. It was Lord of the Rings.
Okay.
And people queued, and it was a big event when Lord of the Rings came out. And at that point, you were starting to see it more, that there were more DVDs being requested, and the videotapes were looking a little bit dishevelled. And then that's at that point Blockbuster really started to push on, really, and sell DVDs. That was a big thing for them. Big problem that they had was, though, is that they didn't buy Netflix when they had the chance, Blockbuster. And now it's lost to nostalgia, isn't it? Being what it's apt to be talking about it today.
Yeah, but I used to make literally a pilgrimage on the bus, because I didn't use to drive. I was living in Lampeter in West Wales, so the only way, if you didn't have a car, the only way you could get to the big city was on the Trouse-Cumbria service that ran once a day. So if you missed it, you'd have to wait till the following weekend. So I get the bus into Swansea, and there was a Blockbuster, a good half an hour walk from the centre of Swansea. But there, you could buy ex-rental videos for about 20 quid.
That's right.
And I've got quite a few, and of course, often they'd be a bit mangled. But it was either that or wait another 6 whole months, because we didn't have Netflix in those days, before you could buy the video. So The Game, I remember, the one with Michael Douglas, I enjoyed it so much at the cinema.
It's a great film.
I paid £20 or even £25 for an ex-rental copy. And they were always a bit bigger than the versions that you would then be able to buy 6 months later. So in my office, where I've got all of these nostalgic items, you can see, you know, and they might as well just say on it, you know, Swansea 1998 or something on them, because that was a big deal. Because these days, it's almost too easy. You can just press a button and watch the film. But in those days, people would physically have to go into Blockbuster, and either they knew what they were going to look for, or they would just presumably browse the shelves.
Yes, absolutely. And you quite often had regular customers who'd come and ask you, they said, what should I get today? Hmm. And you would choose for them, and then they would trust your opinion, so they'd come back. But there was two interesting things. One was that we used to fine people if they didn't rewind the tape, which was all interesting. And then after a while, the DVD started to become a problem because of all the scratches. Yes. So then people would revert back to the video, or you'd give them the video because there was too many scratches, etc. And you know, those are the types of things I remember. And it's for my children, trying to explain renting DVDs and things, it's just mind-blowing. But you have to go, because some games still come with Blu-ray or whatever, and that they find that very, very funny that you have to go out and get a DVD.
But, and it's the same with mine, and of course also vinyl, because vinyl has come back, but there was that time, probably around the time that DVDs came in, when nobody was buying vinyl, and with the crackle, the hiss, which also made it feel very authentic. And yet, sometimes for me, there was something about CDs and DVDs where, because it was digital, because it was pristine, it was almost a bit too perfect. Because these were the days when you'd have, in the cinema, on the top right-hand corner of the screen, you'd see the reel, you know, where the joints had to be made. And you'd be watching a film, how far you were into the film sometimes because of that logo. So I think that transition is an interesting one because, you know, growing up, where there would have to be a projectionist, you'd have to stay there pretty much for the whole film because they'd have to change the reel after 20 minutes. These days, I think they have one projectionist for the entire cinema. They just literally just let it all run. So different era.
Absolutely. And so rentals and things like that for us in Guernsey were hugely important. It was why it was one of the busiest Blockbusters in the UK. In Guernsey, and the Jersey one was also. They had a little bit more in Jersey. They've got a Cineworld in Jersey. We're a bit jealous.
Well, I was going to say, so in those days, was there a cinema?
Yes, in Jersey there was, and then they got a posh Cineworld. In fact, Henry Cavill is from Jersey, and they did this odd thing for Superman a few years ago, where they went to each of the stars' homes to do a premiere. So yeah, Russell Crowe and Henry Cavill and. Amy Adams all turned up to the Cineworld Jersey, which was, of course, quite a stir a few years ago. But no, we weren't lucky enough to have a Cineworld in Guernsey. But we loved our Blockbuster, and I absolutely loved working at Blockbuster. It was such a great thing for an 18-year-old to just rent as much as they like. And as it was a great uni job as well.
Yeah. And what were the sort of films that you were recommending to people? Were you sort of trying to tailor it to what you thought they might like, depending on their age or what they previously ordered?
Absolutely, absolutely. So you get your regular. Usually, what most people want is whatever's popular, or they may say, you know, what's a good thriller or American Beauty. I remember recommending that a lot because that didn't do amazingly well at the box office, although it did win Best Oscar, didn't it? But rentals did, you know, have their life of their own. The real famous one was Shawshank Redemption, that absolutely bombed at the box office, but had this new life in rentals. And is one of the most rented films of all time.
Yeah. I remember that. Actually, I saw The Shawshank Redemption at the cinema when it came out. So I was one of those very few people. And I remember it got a 5-star review in Empire. And a friend of mine wanted to see Little Women. And so she said, well, Shawshank Redemption is just like Men in a Prison, you know. And Little Women is you know, a different demographic. Anyway, we tossed a coin for it. And Shawshank won. And she said afterwards, actually, probably one of the best films I've ever watched. So it was literally down to the toss of a coin as to whether I saw that at the cinema. I think I saw it again in Aberystwyth, at the Commodore there, around 1995. And I bought my copy in Blockbuster in Swansea, maybe our price in Swansea, in 96. And it was one of those, you know, you were literally waiting for the day of its release. I think I even... because I was a student in those days, and I literally, you know, got the bus, especially on the Monday, down to the cinema, and then came back again and said to my friends, I'm watching The Shawshank Redemption tonight, do you want to come on? And everyone did. So in a funny way, that was a nice sort of community, but it feels so strange from today's standards.
Absolutely. And, you know, I can't think of many things. You know, series, that seems to be the thing that gets the word of mouth now, isn't it? A good series or a good box set that seems to do the rounds. But films doesn't seem to work like that, really. They don't really get these new lives on online. You get a few that suddenly turn up on Netflix and things like that haven't ordinarily been... my daughter was watching Honey, I Shrank the Kids the other day. I was like, have you found that? So that some of the more older films do get a new life online. But it was different back then. It really was. It really could have an entirely new life of film from rental, watching at home and taking a punt on something, not knowing what to watch. That evening on a Friday or Saturday night. Again, still, when everything's at your fingertip, it still blows people's minds that you actually went to a shop to rent a film rather than just press play on Amazon Prime or Netflix or Disney Plus.
Yeah, I think I'm still beholden to that kind of paradigm because I think after being at work all day, the last thing I want to do is just sit and randomly, oh, what shall I watch? There has to be a sort of, you know, because I was brought up in that. You mentioned E.T. That was one of the first films I saw, and I saw it in 82. So it didn't work out. I think it was released around Christmas time in 1982, and I think it was actually released on the same day as Blade Runner, which I certainly...
Another great film.
And at the time, Blade Runner just sank without a trace. Mm. And obviously E.T. was a big deal with all the marketing, the merchandising. Everyone would come into school with their E.T. toys. Mm. But that felt like a different era, which there's a part of it that wants to capture while it's still there. Because, you know, I'd like to think, and I'm sure some cinemas will continue to do what they do well. But it, certainly since lockdown, it does feel that that's a particular medium that perhaps has lost its thrill. Because, I mean, Cineworld here across Kent have been showing lots of action films lately. Like I saw Commodore the other day, came out in 1985. That would have been a big cinema release. Mm. I was 12 at the time. I didn't watch it, obviously, 18 rated. But it's curious that sometimes these films can do well in different formats. Mm. But these are the sort of films that, once upon a time, the only way to watch them, unless you were prepared to wait for them to come on TV, was on the big screen.
Absolutely. I remember, and then, you know, at university, without jumping too far ahead, I studied Hitchcock during my course. And... you know, that interesting thing about Psycho was it was the first film that people were required to watch it from start to finish. And it's the same kind of what we're talking about here, people not getting their heads around that you couldn't just have films at the touch of a button. But similarly, you just used to go to films, and if you walked in at the end, you caught the end of the film and then you watched the first half and you stayed there and watched it. But Psycho was the first one where it was like, no, he wanted to get across get that shock factor that the big star Janet Leigh was killed off early on, and the big twist at the end with, spoiler alert, if you've not watched Psycho, then, you know, where have you been? But and that Norman Bates had ended up being his mother, you know, that big twist. He didn't want to give that away and changed theatre going.
You've just reminded me that my mum used to tell me about how in her youth that's exactly what you would do. You'd buy the ticket for the film and you just go into the screen, and if the film was three quarters of the way through, well, you just sat there and it would start all over again and you'd leave at that point. Even by today's standards with TV, I suppose people can stop and start, you might be able to rewind, but the idea that you would just start a film three quarters of the way through, and if you like what you're watching, you know, you might go back to the beginning, is a very curious affair. But it's those sort of oddities, I think, which it's the same as queuing up outside a public phone box at 6 o'clock in the evening when it was cheaper to do so, in order to speak to your parents. I mean, I did that for a decade or more when I was at university. I mean, looking back now, I mean, my children have got mobile phones. You know, it's laughable that you actually physically stand in a queue in order to make a phone call. But there's a part of me that wonders if something from the future, like I saw 2001 A Space Odyssey the other day, but if somebody had said, in the future, we'll have mobile phones, you'll have Netflix, you know, thing. I wonder what, you know, black and white TVs were the norm. If you're a student in those days, chances are you'd have a black and white TV. You know, even teletext was sort of like seen to be, wow, you know, you've entered the brave new world of the 1990s. But I wonder what the future version of ourselves would have divulged to us back then, and how we would have received, you know, the idea that films could just be accessed at the touch of a button.
Well, it does feel like we're in Star Trek, really. Yeah. That Geordi LaForge with his PDA, that's essentially what they're saying. Well, an iPhone is, or the replicator, and the holodecks that they have, and you know, it all does feel very, very at the time watching. Well, that can never happen, but it's there. We're with augmented reality. AI is really. I knew that we wouldn't get through this without me talking about AI. This seems to be the buzz thing for everyone to talk about at the moment. And KMTV, in fact, we've been looking at AI research and stuff like that with the way television is consumed. But the way that I would look at the future was mind-boggling with watching Space Odyssey. That's a great example. Back to the Future as well. That was a big hit of mine. I loved it when I was a kid. I quite like the third one. Not many people like Back to the Future 3 when they're in the Wild West, but I quite like that. Yeah. But the second one with like the hoverboards and all those things.
Actually, the third one was the first one I saw.
Oh, really?
Yeah, at the cinema. And I missed one and two. Two is kind of my favourite because it does it doesn't necessarily do it successfully, but it does all the jumbling around. And it's almost like, you know, when you're a student and you're writing an essay and you do multiple drafts, it's a bit like that. And you go back over the original thing and try to perfect it, but fail maybe in that endeavour. Maybe it was you're better off just leaving it, you know, the first time around.
Absolutely. But it was a great trilogy. And, you know, I'd love to see a fourth Back to the Future come back, but who knows? But
there is a stage show.
There is a stage show. There is, which I'd love to see as well. But that's happening more and more as well, which I think is really, really interesting. That trying to bring those two worlds together. Because I do enjoy going to the theatre, and Stranger Things have done that. You know, we're moving to TV a bit, but really successfully. They've got Netflix have spent a fortune on a stage show there, but using it as a prequel for the television series, and really adds to the story and that universe. That's the other, you know, terminology that Marvel have helped get into the world, that cinematic universe, or the universe that that these stories live in. And Harry Potter as well, big Harry Potter fans in our house. The stage show for that is absolutely fantastic as well, and builds it all in. But I think there's something really great about going to the theatre and having something tangible in front of you. I know that they've done National Theatre Live and all those things at the cinema. I've not been to one. Not sure about watching theatre on the TV. I'm not sure about that, but I will try it. Yeah. But I absolutely love going to the theatre as well. I just wish I could go more. And I think it's really coming back now since the pandemic. It was a real challenge. Yeah. You know, I know people close to me who were right at the top of their game, were, you know, having to consider driving delivery vans, and they, you know, Olivier Award winning people, you know, because that's the industry was so damaged, and it's just so great to see theatre really, really thriving again. Particularly in the West End, but I know we kind of moved on to theatre.
Well, no, but I was going to say, because when you were growing up, so there wasn't a cinema, but could you, I mean, like Herne Bay has a little theatre, you know, were there sort of Amdram type opportunities back then, or was that something that, as in my case, just passed me by, you know, only like in later years? It's like when you take your children to play areas. My parents, they said, these didn't exist when I was growing up, or maybe they did exist, we just didn't know about them. But you know, these sort of things that you look back on and think, yeah, if we'd had these 30 years ago, we would have done things differently. But was theatre something that you were aware of?
Absolutely. So yeah, I'll go back to the beginning now. So when you're from the Channel Islands, there's usually a big connection to finance, because it's what's described as a low tax jurisdiction. Basically, people pay lower tax there, as do corporations. So there's lots of accountants. So my father was a tax accountant. My mother met him at HMRC and then was an accountant. My eldest sister is an accountant. Her husband is an accountant. You get the gist. Me and my middle sister were a bit different. She went into acting. She went to drama school. and I ended up being a journalist. And I think a big reason for that is because we always had real access to the arts. It was really important to my mother in particular. She's a big musician, she teaches the guitar and things like that. So growing up, I had as much access to the arts as I could ever have wanted. And so I did a bit of acting and went to a couple of drama residential trips as a kid, kind of helped me out because I was not great in class. I wasn't the best, most academic pupil, but I really had this kind of urge to get into the arts, and music was important to me as well as sport. So that kind of moulded me a bit, and you know, I never felt that I didn't have opportunities to engage with the arts. And you know, the people that I speak to now and the job that I do, you know, a lot of what I do is teaching. I think it's massively important that no matter what field you're in, is to get that kind of sense of yourself and to understand. You know, everyone's got a bit of a performer in them, and it does, you know, really help you form who you are.
Yeah, but it's the counterpoint thing as well, because you mentioned the family who are involved in tax affairs. Mm. But often you find this with scientists. You find it with people who are, you know, whose day job might be involved with data or with finance. There has to be something else. And it may be amateur dramatics. It may be something very creative. And also people who work in the arts. I mean, it was pointed out to me once that, you know, the people often who do a lot of acting full time or broadcasting can often be quite introverted. And so when they're not doing that sort of thing on air, they retreat into the background. So it's the people who are the introverts in their jobs who then do very extrovert type things. I'm sure you see it at KMTV as well. You know, the sort of people behind the camera, in front of the camera, the way that in different contexts they may be interchangeable. But I always find that very interesting. The way that sometimes we sort of follow career paths and personal paths, but they have to be in alignment. And by alignment, that often means that you move off in one direction with one side of those things, and the other is in the other. And that's ironically the best kind of balance that you could find.
Absolutely, I couldn't agree more. And you know, sometimes I think personally I forget that, and you know, because you get so kind of intertwined and there's a lot of pressure with work and everything, and if you've got a busy household like I do, it's hard to think back to those times when you could really engage yourself in doing that. But then you start to, you know, live vicariously through your children as well, and you know, my daughter's learning the piano and she really enjoys it. She's made her own band. I was giving her band name suggestions this morning. She's only 11, but they've got a big performance at school tomorrow, which I'll be going to watch. And I just think, but it just really kind of shows that how things can be inspiring. And you know, I think without getting too political, politics is a big thing in my life. Love politics. I think it's really important that we all play an active role in that as well. But I would just love to see more investment in the arts. And you know, doing maths until you're 18 is fine. As I know, that's what the current Prime Minister, who knows?
By the time this goes out,
who that might be. But that's all very good. But there was a great rant with a few expletives from Simon Pegg. Go look it up, Chris. With him, when that was first announced, about learning maths to your 18, he said, all the maths I needed to do by the age of 12, and that's all I've needed. And what about, you know, writing? What about understanding who people are? It's a great rant. Do go look it up. But I think it is so important to have a really balanced society, and give people the opportunity to what they, you know, to be themselves and to express themselves. And that's the best thing about the arts, is express yourself. You can't really express yourself in a spreadsheet, but some accountants will say they can.
Yeah,
that's for sure.
Yeah, but also, what are those accountants doing when they're not on a spreadsheet? exactly.
Making another spreadsheet. But it's true though. You know, there is a massive. If you look at the arts and production, so since going into international and a national production, you know, we've done a series for ITV. There is a real lack of people who are getting into production accounting and understanding those things. To, you know, I do think there does need to be a balance, you know, that just, you're not boring just because you work with figures. Like you were saying, it's about what you do. Why not combine those two things? Why not have an accountant come and work on a kid's animation program, or have someone, you know, that's the other thing which I found really interesting was when when I went to university, so it's kind of moving on to that a little bit, but I went to university at the University of Teesside. It was a really young uni. It was very, very young at the time. But they had really invested in the facilities were amazing. And they had this supercomputer that they did some rendering for some Hollywood films, actually. Lost in Space was, well, it's a terrible film, but they were very proud that they'd done the rendering for Lost in Space. It's Matt LeBlanc's one and only one only film. It was a massive flop, but at the time they were very excited.
I saw that in the same week as Armageddon in Swansea in 98, and I agree with your assessment.
Yes, yeah, Armageddon was okay, a bit cheesy, but Lost in Space was definitely a flop. But anyway, it was rendered at the University of Teesside. And anyway, so I didn't think I wanted to go to university. I was told that I was not capable of going to university. So when I was at school, I went to private school, and it was a difficult time for private schools and education in general in the mid-90s, and kind of coming out the other side of quite traditional, hard, strict. You know, I got hit a couple of times at my school, that kind of thing, by teachers. It was coming through that, and I didn't do very well in my GCSEs. I only got a handful of C's. I wasn't particularly bothered about that. My dad had only got 2 O-levels, and he was my absolute hero. He was very understanding, my family were understanding, but my school said that they didn't think that I would be capable of getting grades that would allow me to go to university. So they said I either resit all of the GCSEs again or to leave. So I made the decision to leave. And I went to a state school, sixth form college. I worked a bit harder. That's probably the best way to describe it. But I got inspired by teachers there. And I got inspired by doing more vocational subjects. Again, at the private school, it was, you know, very traditional physics, maths. But I did media studies, business studies, and ASs had just come around. And I did theatre studies. So business studies, theatre studies, media studies. All the studies. But I was engaged, and I found teachers who were excited for me that I could get some grades. So I didn't go through UCAS. And then I got my grades, and they were okay. I won't say what they are, but they were okay. They were good enough for me to go to university. I remember going to the careers advisor and said, I've changed my mind, I want to go to university. And he said, you're the first person who's done this, who's not been through UCAS, and then produced this form that he'd never filled out before for someone who hasn't done UCAS and is just starting the application going through clearing. And then we spotted the University of Teesside, and I was there 2 weeks later. Yeah. And it was just, I couldn't believe that you could go to class and talk about things I enjoyed.
I've heard this story, and my own experience of people, when I was at school, I mean, I found that there were always people better. Of course there were. But, I mean, the school I went to, which was the Church and Wales School in Cardiff, was, looking back, the sort of grammar school equivalents, but there's no point of reference. We knew we were in a good school. And it was very unusual for somebody not to go on to A-level and then not to go on to university. So those who didn't were kind of looked down upon a bit. Yes. As in, you know, whereas when I went to university, people would say, oh, I was one of only 4 people who went to university. You're thinking, you know, that is not my experience. Now, I remember friends at school, I was always intimidated. Those who did maths particularly, or sciences, and they were just so clever. We didn't have A stars in those days, but the ones who you knew would always get the top range. I was all B's and C's. Then I met them a few years later, and I was thinking, gosh, they're going to really grill me that I did an arts and humanities degree. And then found out that maybe they went to university and dropped out. And I was like, but they were on this wonderful trajectory. But those people, we have many of those through, you know, continuing learning opportunities, those who maybe were written off when they were in school, but who then discover that actually maybe at school they were forced to read Shakespeare and the teacher couldn't be bothered to teach them, or it was just a horrendous experience, or they were just reading it out. And, you know, you can't read, you know, in Latin or whatever. You can't read all the, you know, Middle English.
Latin was terrible for me.
I know. But then later on, you discover, and these are the ones who get the first class degrees. Mm-hmm. And so the students and maybe your experience of being on the Channel Islands as well is something I'm interested in, that because you didn't have everything at your fingertips that maybe somebody on the mainland had, that you had to work a bit harder and try a bit harder to attain it. So, and that was going to be my next question about Teesside, because it's almost as far away as you can get.
Absolutely.
Certainly as far as within England is concerned. So that would have been around...
2000.
I went to Middle... What's the name of the town? Middlesbrough.
Middlesbrough, yeah.
Right, I've been there. So tell me a bit then about what that was like, because I take it that all your education was on the Channel Islands, in the state school. So when you went to the University of Teesside, you mentioned just a moment ago that your experience of going to the classroom was one, you know, you can learn and you can want to learn and be encouraged to learn on your own terms. But did it suddenly make you rethink the whole nature of education?
Oh, massively. I think... in hindsight, because eventually it was too much for me. It was honestly taking an 18-year-old kid who'd been to with quite a sheltered life. I'd been at private school and then gone to sixth form college, and just kind of parachuting into a really hard town, like Middlesbrough. Whilst I was there, I think it was top of the league tables for stabbings, for prostitution, for drugs. It was a really challenging time for Middlesbrough, and the locals were wonderful. I met some great friends, some real great friends, people that I would walk into a room, I've not seen them in 20 years, and would sit and have an amazing chat. But it was a real challenge for this 18-year-old, and also the logistics, as you were just saying, was so difficult. There was, you know, Teesside didn't fly to Guernsey, so I'd have to get trains to Manchester or Birmingham or down to London, then a flight back. So it wasn't easy just to get on a plane and go. But that first year, it was just kind of unleashing a teenager onto the world. That's how I kind of felt. Like you said, I wasn't used to have anything at your fingertips. We didn't even have McDonald's in Guernsey, right? It was unbelievable that you could have whatever you wanted, whenever you wanted. And I had this complete freedom, having been in this quite structured environment back in Guernsey. So I kind of, you know, had a good time in the first year, but eventually burnt out. And so my family and I decided that the best thing for me, because one thing I always had was a great work ethic, always have. And so I came home, I dropped out my second year, just before Christmas, because it wasn't working out. I came home, I worked, and then I achieved enough credits to transfer straight to what was called University College Chichester at the time. Now it's the University of Chichester. It's a really good university, actually. It's doing very well in the league tables now. And I transferred there, and I did had two fantastic years in Chichester as well. But what I learned about myself in Middlesbrough, like really kind of, you know, I'm not trying to be snobby or anything like that, but really getting involved with the working class, understanding what some of the challenges are for some really deprived areas in the UK compared to this kind of middle class society in Guernsey. Don't get me wrong, there is real poverty issues there too. The disparity is bad in the Channel Islands because everything is so expensive and there are lots of working class people there. But to really kind of have that interaction as an 18, 19-year-old was eye-opening and has made me who I am today, 100%.
Yeah, I found when I went to uni in the early 90s, there were a lot of people who, you know, because in those days you didn't have to pay fees and people were like, oh, well, you know, we can just do what we want. And you see people at graduation who did the same degree as you and you'd never see them in lectures. But my ethic was always, yes, I'll go to every lecture, I'll never miss a deadline, but I will also get on the bar every night. In other words, I was in a town without a cinema. They used to have a makeshift one on a Sunday night. That's where my love of cinema actually grew. I never went to the cinema when I was young. So it's always about making up in later years, compensating as an adult for the things you didn't do as a child. But whereas the people who went to the cinema every week as a child, they stopped doing that now. They're the people who say, you know, they're in bed at 10:30 with a cup of coffee, and I'm like the one in the morning writing away. So I think everyone finds their own sort of niche. But that was the thing for me about education, is that there were some people who were like, well, you know, education is a privilege, as if then not going to classes was also a privilege. Whereas I would sort of say it is a privilege, but you need to, for me, the perfect balance is not miss a single class, but also not miss a night down the bar. And the two actually are not incompatible. But if I suddenly stopped going to lectures, you know, then my paranoia would be going down the bar and one of my lecturers saying, he wasn't in class, so that never happened. But we all find our own way through this. But so you went to Winchester then for...
Chichester
for 2 years.
Yeah.
Now, what was that like as an experience? Because you did media studies, is that right?
Entirely different,
yeah.
I would say. Entirely different. I made some good friends in Chichester, but again, really middle class, quite traditional courses. The funny thing about Chichester, and I'm sorry for any University of Chichester alumni or lecturers listening, but quite most of what goes on there is in Bognor Regis, but no one wants to call it the University of Bognor Regis. So you basically spend your time going back and forth to Bognor, and that's where the nightclub was, that's where everything was. So it was actually quite hard to have an active nightlife, that's probably the best way to describe it. Whereas in Middlesbrough, they had clubs everywhere, and Newcastle, what an amazing city that is, by the way, nearby. There was a lot to distract, where in Chichester, I knew I can't drop out again. I've got to get through my degree, and I, you know, went to almost all lectures. I've really kind of got my head down and got through my degree, because I always knew that once I got through my degree, I was pretty confident that I would do quite well, because I've always had a job. You know, I've worked at Safeway, for those too old to remember, too young to remember Safeway. It's essentially a supermarket. Pushing trolleys and whatever from when I was 14. So I'd always worked. So I knew that once I got into a career, I'd be okay. It's the education side. But, you know, back to what you were saying, you know, I might not have gone to many lectures or only had, you know, limited interaction whilst I was in Teesside, but it taught me so much. And particularly for kids from the Channel Islands, it's really important to understand the bigger world out there. And I'd say it's the same for people from smaller villages. To this day, you know, I'm 42 now, to this day, I still find it mad that I can get in a car and be in Cornwall in 4 hours. Now, coming from Guernsey, that having that thought of being able just to go somewhere else. You know, we used to do that in Middlesbrough, you know, should we go to Sheffield tonight? You know, wow, let's go. Wow, you can get in a car and drive somewhere. Or get on a train, like, getting on a train was also interesting. Yeah, I learned so much without going to too many lectures in Middlesbrough. It taught a lot about me, about myself, and I wouldn't change it for the world. Other than some of the challenging times, you could tick everything off. I got burgled twice. We had a squatter. I've got mugs, all kinds of things, but I think in life you've got to have some adversity, you know, without trying to get into saying, oh, everyone's too soft these days. It did harden me up. It left some scars, but I kind of needed to go through some challenges to know that not everything's just going to be handed to you, and there are difficult and challenging places. And also sort of stop and ask that question, you know, why has this person burgled my house? Why are they so desperate to nick 20 quid's worth of stuff, and to understand that it's not just because they're evil bad people, it's because they're genuinely living in poverty, so they'll target the students to steal from to live. And
yes.
that was something that was my socialist kind of ideas and views came through. Although as a journalist I'm not supposed to have a political persuasion.
Well, I mean, we'll come on to journalism in a minute, but in your career there, or here indeed, but that thing about the bullies, it's interesting because I was interviewing somebody for my podcast who was in her 70s, and she looked at the very microphone that we're recording on now, and she said, I've been waiting since 1950 somewhere with her to say this, and she named the three people who had caused her life misery at school, and actually luckily their names were, they were Welsh names like David Williams, John Jones, and so I was like, yes, so actually we're probably not going to get sued. And it's like 60 years on, and she didn't name which school, so I was satisfied that this was not going to rebound. But that was an interesting thing, because what about the bullies? Now, where are they 60 years on in that person's case? do they have children or grandchildren of their own? Do they ever stop and wonder, looking back, about, but more importantly, what made them do the things that they do in the way that they did? And I think that that's something which I'll come to a bit later when we talk about that whole notion of whether you can be nostalgic or, you know, about negative experiences. But I, before we do that, I just want to find out about your the third stage of the journey, at least I assume it's the third stage, which is how you got into journalism. So obviously your degree in media, it's an obvious route in, but obviously your channel director, I think it's in 2015 you've mm-hmm. been here. So how did that come about?
Yeah, so I kind of got through, you talk to media studies students now and they say exactly the same thing as I did 20 years ago, where they don't really know, they just know that they like media, but what does that mean? If I do a media studies degree, it's kind of non-committal to what type of media that I'm going to go into. But I had this real passion for radio. I really enjoyed radio. I loved listening to it. Loved listening to it with my dad. Even like dramatisations and things, you know, I was such a strange boy. I loved Tony Hancock and Blackadder and all the had all these tapes of listening to these old school comedians. You know, like I was talking to you in the film club about yeah. picking Carry On Sergeant. And but I always had this real love for it. And then my sister, when I graduated, my sister found this ad in the local paper for this journalist role at a radio station. Broadcast journalist. I was like, I hadn't really thought about journalism, but it's working for the radio. Oh, I'd read the news. That sounds fun. Which I'm still in awe of all these students, these undergraduate journalism students who know they want to be a journalist. I had no idea I wanted to be a journalist until I was a journalist. I had no idea. I kind of completely fell into it. And I went to this job interview. I managed to secure this job interview, and he turned out to be my, you know, great mentor. He sadly died a couple of years ago. My old boss Gary Burgess, who is a bit of a legend in local news, the local news industry, and I started this interview. I had no idea what I was talking about. I could see that he was doodling. He was doodling whilst I was doing the interview. I was going, "This is going very badly." And he said, "And what newspapers do you like to read?" And at that point, I wasn't reading newspapers, really. I was, you know, it was the beginning of the internet, really, or having wide, you know, wide access to it. And so I was like, "Well, you know, I like to read the local paper, and I really like to read the Sunday Guardian," which I meant, and I meant yeah. The Observer, obviously. And, you know, to the day he died, he made fun of me yeah. for that. Anyway, so clearly I did not get the job. And I so I kind of was licking my wounds after this terrible first proper job. I'd been to job interviews before for, you know, my Safeway job, Blockbuster, but this was the first career job, so I was kind of licking my wounds. And then I'd secured some work experience at the local BBC. And I was in there, I got this phone call, and it was Island FM again, this place where I'd gone for these interviews. "We'd like to ask you back for a couple of days' trial." And I was like, "Oh, okay." So I'll get to why in a minute. So I turned back up, and they said, "Right, okay, this is what you do. Look through the papers, or look through this report, see what you can find, and then try and write something, and we'll see how we get on." It was my first news editor, Katie Collins. Anyway, I was looking at this report, and it was about these plans for a casino. There was a big story in Guernsey. There was going to be this casino. They were going to see that it was a real opportunity for the island. And I'd seen this line there saying, you know, "And we decided not to take our plans forward," or whatever. Or there was a line in there. I was like, "That doesn't make sense." And I turned to her and said, "This doesn't make sense. They're saying here that they're not going to do the casino, but you've asked me to do this." So he said, "Wow, that's amazing." So we did the interview with this guy, and he said, "Yeah, we've actually decided not to do it." And then they were so excited about the story. And then the next day it was on the BBC, it was on ITV, it was, and it had been this little kind of thing that I had spotted. I just fell in love. Yeah. I just, at that moment, I fell in love with journalism at that point. I just completely enthralled myself with newspapers, radio, TV. I just got the bug of finding out information. And then it kind of developed that, you know, what I couldn't get in Guernsey. Now, this is why I suppose I've always stayed in local news and why I'm so passionate about it. The other thing that I couldn't get my head round was that there were, you know, the equivalent to councillors in the Channel Islands, or in Guernsey in particular, are called deputies. They're like MPs. They're kind of a hybrid MP slash councillor. And I couldn't get my head around how these people could be elected just by trying a bit. That they just need a couple of hundred votes. And they were making all these decisions. And it really frustrated me that people didn't realise and they weren't voting. And so I was like, well, we have to ask questions of these people because they clearly don't have... the skill set to be able to do these jobs, and then they're making decisions for us all. This is crazy. How can that be? And it's so similar in our political system. The day we're recording this are the local elections, and I'm expecting that the turnout's not going to be good, and that people won't really understand, and they don't really. They all think it's Rishi Sunak's fault and central government's fault, but don't understand that the types of decisions that affect them. Are really down to these hyper local areas and your parish councils and your borough council, all these types of things. And I just fell in love with it, and I worked so hard, and I loved the radio side of it as well. But I suppose that's kind of what I learned in those kind of first four or five years of my career. But it wasn't the radio that I really loved; it was the journalism. The radio was fantastic, but it was finding that story, understanding who your audience is and telling them information. You kind of got to be a professional gossip. You have to want information to burst out of you. If you hear something, you've got to want to tell someone. You've got to be like, oh, I can't wait to tell so and so this. That is kind of the fundamental sort of journalism, and that is definitely in me.
And sometimes now these things can be an 18-year-old. I think in my case it was, but at the age of 6 or 7, when radio, I fell in love with radio. And some years later, someone said to me, you know, what would your epitaph be? Or what would be, if you had to define yourself in one word, what would it be? What would be on your tombstone? Or stuff like 19th century Wild West. And I thought, well, theologian felt wrong, because although my background is in theology and I teach that, and I thought, well, there's something else that maybe people don't know about. So, I mean, when I was at university, if I saw one of my lecturers in the supermarket, it was like, they do their own shopping, how can that be? You know, these days, there's me going out to the cinemas and doing selfies in front of film posters and doing that. But I think that I'm channeling something that I always had in me. But there's no way at the age of 6 or 7, I would have been in a position to know what the audience was. And I think that I realised I haven't actually changed very much in 35, 40 years. I wrote to Mark Goodyear. When he was on Radio 1 in 1988, and I've got the handwritten letter, and he gave me advice as to how to get into radio. He said, don't try it before you're 25. Well, I've succeeded in that. He said, get a university degree. Well, I overshot on that, well, on that score, and listen to Radio 4 so you know what's going on in the news. And actually, it's actually brilliant advice, although in my case, I've waited 35 years rather than 5 or 6 years to follow it up. But there is something in what you're saying about how sometimes you know what you need to do, but you're not always going to be able to do it. Like that interview you had, when you look back on it, and you know it was a disaster, but you know you wouldn't do that now. But the only way you know you wouldn't do it now is because you've learned from it, and you've learned from hard experience.
Absolutely. And, you know, I must have, you know, I laugh it off, but I must have shown something in the interview. Otherwise they wouldn't have asked me back. And Gary always said to me that you could just see that there was something, that I was a nice guy, I was clearly going to work hard, and, you know, he thought my voice was okay. He had this great knack of hearing someone and understanding if they were going to be a good broadcaster or not. And he just gave me so many opportunities. I thought I might talk about Gary a bit in this conversation. He just gave me so many opportunities, and that's what I've learned from him, is to let people run with it. Why get so bent out of shape of having protocol and... well, you clearly can't hold the camera yet because you haven't done this, this, and this, and this. what, just let people get on with it and learn from experience. We've done that this week with Daisy, our recently appointed apprentice. We've got some logistics problems next week for people to present the late bulletin. I said, Daisy can go and do it. And they're like, what? My goodness. So Daisy's like, really? He said, of course you can. You've got a great voice. You understand the process. Go learn. This is what I love about KMTV. And we'll get on to KMTV in more detail. But that's what I was really taught at that point, was you're not doing open heart surgery. You're a sensible human being. You know what the protocols are. Go do it. And that's really, I kind of was dropped into the deep end. I kind of rose up to news editor within 2 years. So I was running. So by the time I was about 24, 25, I was running the news team, which had two other people in it. And I was faking it till I made it. But it was such a fantastic experience. I loved it. And, you know, whilst I was there, as well as the news, he let me kind of explore myself as a presenter as well. And, you know, gave me a sports program on a Saturday. So I did that for a couple of hours. Me and one of the other guys had a Saturday night show. We just mucked around for 4 hours, basically. I did cover for the mid-morning show. I did drive time. I even did the CD. It's how old it is, the CD chart. So I did the album chart on a Saturday. It was great fun. And it really kind of taught me about how to try things. But also, you know, to have standards. You know, he would do this thing where... And it's still the same today in a radio studio, we call it the external line. So basically, if you did something wrong, you'd see this light go, because it doesn't ring, it's the light starts flashing. Oh no. Hi, we have, what happened there then? I didn't prepare my bulletin that way. Okay, well, you learn for next time, won't you? Yeah, okay. So it's having that balance, and this is what I've tried to replicate as a manager, in that it's not about being in trouble to be told off. It's about letting someone down and letting the standards down of the organisation that you're working for. Not like, oh, I'm just going to get grief again. It's about having, not wanting to let your manager down. That's the best manager you can have, is someone you totally respect and you want to meet their standards, rather than just being worried about getting in the neck for the 1500th time or something silly.
But there's that thing about, well, there's also an element of wanting to come back, or wanting to be allowed to come back, but also it's learning from it.
Yes.
It's that sense that you've done something and maybe your own self-judgment tells you, okay, maybe you shouldn't have done that. But the crucial thing is that, you know, you don't go away and try and pretend it didn't happen or avoid it next time. You actually go in, you know, even more determined to get it right. And maybe that's a recipe for life. It's almost that sort of, you know, we don't always in life get second or third chances. But sometimes if we do get them, then actually we are all the more hungry for them, because it matters perhaps even more than we realised.
Absolutely. And also it's about having self-confidence in yourself, that if you've been given a role, then yes, you're going to make mistakes, but you have to be self-confident that, well, you know that you're good at what you do. So if you make a mistake, you make a mistake and you own it. You know, one of the things that I do here is help, and I really value, is help to manage young managers. Now, young managers are some of the harshest managers you will ever come across. Your first inclination is that you think that they're going to be really supportive, because essentially they're peers, but they're not. They're so harsh. Because the first thing that is connected to a young manager is, I am boss, so therefore I tell you you are wrong. You know, rather than, you know, I'm your boss, I want to tell you how proud of you are, I am, or how it's okay. It's always, they always go, you know, you've done this wrong, you've done that wrong, you've done this wrong, you've done that wrong, please don't do that again. And it's just absolutely the wrong way to approach management. And then the other way around as well is that if the manager's got something wrong, certainly the young ones, they find it out really hard to admit to a subordinate, because then they think that they're going to be judged in the job that they're doing if they're not a very good manager. I say, no, that's not... They'll respect you more. And the other thing is when you do have someone quite difficult, I'm going to use an analogy in a minute that I use with everybody, and again, people will laugh because I use this with lots of people. But if you basically lay it all out what you've done wrong, then there's nothing to come back with. So there's this, I don't know if you see it, you've seen every film in the world, it feels like, Chris. But the film 8 Mile, have you seen
the film 8 Mile? Yeah, I do. It came on with our film club a few weeks ago.
So in the film 8 Mile, it's a good film, I do like 8 Mile, but the analogy that I always use with young managers or for anyone going into any conflict with somebody, I use the analogy of the end of the film when Eminem's coming up to his big rap battle with his nemesis. Mm. And instead of, you know, saying all the cusses and all the whatever the disses of who he's battling, he lists all the things that are wrong about him. And he lists everything that he could possibly say. He owns absolutely everything terrible that's about him and makes fun of his friends and everything. So when it comes to the guy who's going to do to deliver hit, he's got nothing to say and he chokes and he loses because he's owned it all. So if you own all your mistakes and you say, I could have done this and this was wrong and I should have done that and we may have let you down here and that could have happened, then the subordinate has got nothing to say. They go, well, you could have done that, and they've got nowhere to go. And they respect you for kind of owning all those tiny little mistakes they all have up.
What you were saying about Eminem is really interesting because I found if you do things in the cover of, you know, open air, no one's really that interested. If you put yourself out all the time and you're very open about what you do, people aren't interested. It's when people think that you've got a secret life. So people who, before I did anything on Facebook or, you know, people would often think, you know, what's going on in Chris's world? But because I'm very open and I'd much rather gossip about myself and be very open with people than to have anyone, you know, speculating what you might be doing, because I'm very open in that sense. So it's a way of turning things round. So you're in control of your own narrative. And often that's forgotten because people sometimes, you know, I know people who are so paranoid that people will, you know, find out all their private things. People are only going to worry if they feel that there's something that's being hidden and it's dodgy. Whereas actually, if you own what you do, then people like say, yeah, I've got it. I understand where that person's coming from. And they're perfectly happy then to almost like let them get on with it and actually celebrate their idiosyncrasies.
Absolutely. And I think also in a working environment, it's also really thinking about consequence properly. What is the consequence of my action? What is the consequence of me pressing the wrong button? Yeah. And someone else's face coming up that shouldn't be. Not a lot. Other than the audience at home to go, ooh,
yeah,
they pressed the wrong button. Is that something really to tell off a young vision mixer? Yeah. No, of course not. You know, they're going to feel in themselves like, oh God, I pressed the wrong button. Oh, that's embarrassing that that's happened. You know, there's no reason to go, right, that you need to think about practicing that more. It's just not the point. Or in the same way, if I went in there and I made a mistake in the gallery tonight, yeah, and I'm telling you that I would. It's like, you know, I would. If I went around the gallery this evening, I would find it a challenge. If I pressed the button and did it wrong and acted like I had done nothing wrong because I'm the boss, and didn't say to everybody, oh gosh, that was terrible of me. Right, you know better than me. You come and sit here because you do this every day. You're way more talented than me right now doing a vision mix. That doesn't belittle me as an authoritative figure here. It's just being real and you know, and respectful of people and understanding of, and, you know, respectful of yourself and having that integrity and that self kind of worth on the job that you're doing, that you don't have to get absolutely everything right. And there are subordinates that are better than you at certain elements. That's the other thing. That's terrible. Bosses think they know everything and they're better at everybody, at absolutely everything.
But also,
and they're just not.
Well, that certainly works in HE as well, because if you know that the students are the most important people in the room, then the students will respect you because you're speaking to them, you're being very open with them and honest with them. The worst scenario is when you go over above the students or don't engage with the students, or you just go above rather than below, inverted commas, and then effectively sort of see the hierarchy and exclude the students who will be the managers of tomorrow. And I have plenty of people in my profession who have admitted this, that maybe they were taught by somebody when they were growing up who would shout at them or put them on the spot or humiliate them. So their technique in teaching is to do the same sort of thing because that's what they're used to. The idea is that you show that you're in control, and you show that you're in control by ensuring that all the people in the room there know that you're the most important person. Whereas I treat it that the students are the most important in the room, and then you have a level playing field and people respect you for that. Mm. And I think that, that's, you know, education when I was growing up. I don't think when I was at school in the 80s, I ever saw going to school as about learning and all the benefits of education. It was about conformity. It was about, you know, because you were told off if you walked on the wrong side of the corridor. So the thing to avoid was being shouted at. Whereas, could you imagine me shouting at my students because maybe they haven't done the seminar reading or they've read the wrong text or they've answered the wrong question? Quite the opposite. And you use that, you turn it around, and that's when you get something very constructive out of it and a dialogue, because you're reflecting on the thing itself rather than it being a binary, this is the right answer, that is the wrong answer.
Oh, absolutely. That's why I switched off at school. You know, I was called by... Again, it was traditional private school. I was called by my number. I had a number. Yeah, numbers.
Mm. Yeah, we had surnames. So, I was always DC. I didn't even... Yeah. Somebody said to me, well, do you want to be Chris or Christopher? And I thought, I'm neither, I'm DC.
Yeah. I was Richards 8860. Oh. No, there we go. So, and you'll notice, Richard, so I've got a Welsh background. My father was Welsh.
Ooh.
And obviously my grandfather, my tide. So that's the thing, I sound English. There's nothing, there's very little English about me. My mother is Scottish, my father was Welsh, and I was born in Guernsey, and I live in Kent now. So my children are English, it's quite hard to say. But yeah, I refer to myself as British. Anyway, so after Island FM, where I just loved working there. I was working there for 4 or 5 years. I then had a very, very, very short stint. This happens to all journalists. I say this to our guys all the time. You get to the point, you go, what am I going to do? You know, unless I'm going to be Gavin Esler or whoever, that path feels hard. What am I going to do? So a lot of us go and flirt with PR, public relations, comms, those types of things. So I had a very, very short stint, and it taught me so much. It was only 6 months. But I went and worked for a PR firm. So you kind of, you know, poach your turn gamekeeper. And I worked for an airline and a telecoms business. And I did their... the airline was fascinating. I did their internal and their external comms. So it was quite a big business, several hundred employees, you know, thousands of users because the getting off on and off the island was important. It was only one or two airlines, so that was really eye-opening, dealing with the public and understand. That's where I started to understand the commercial side of businesses. That's again what lots of people forget. Yeah, there is public service journalism, but other than the BBC, we're all here to make money as well. And this is what's quite often forgotten and a big problem. Maybe we'll talk about the politics around journalism and the real existential threat it's facing later. But I started to understand businesses and I spent 6 months there. And then I was approached. It's a completely random day. It was on a boat in the middle of the English Channel. And the telecoms firm were laying some wire for broadband. So fiber optic broadband was coming to the island, and the ITV journalist, an ITV journalist, was there with their camera operator and said, "Look, Andy, we've got a position opening up. You should apply. I think you'd be great." And so I said, "All right, that sounds kind of cool," and applied for this job at ITV to work as an on-screen reporter, and I got the job, and I was amazed, to be honest. I had a good, you know, I was really kind of plugged into the local government, and I had lots of contacts and all those types of things. But, you know, TV is a completely different medium. It's a completely different way of telling stories. Yes, there is some synergy. You know, we all love good audio, all those types of things. But it was a completely different experience. But I then proceeded just to have the best 4 or 5 years. It was so fun. It was really hard. There were hard yards, but I had, and there's still lots of people who work there at ITV Channel who are still there, been there donkey's years, 30, 40 weeks, and they were just brilliant to learn from. Standards, you know, sequencing, you know, it did matter if something was slightly out of focus. It really kind of helped me understand that medium, and then totally fall in love with another medium. I never thought. I remember back at university, we'd done one module was about journalism, and it was a TV, and we just took the mic, and we did. You know, I did this spoof TV report, and I often think if I'm out of touch with my partner on that project, if they knew that I went on to be an ITV journalist, they would have found that absolutely hilarious. But I just had the best time for 4 or 5 years working at ITV across Jersey and Guernsey. I did a lot over there, and I ended up being the sports correspondent as well, which was a full-time position for that. So I covered all the sport from there. And it was just so fun. It was great.
Who are your role models in this? Who are your role models today in journalism and broadcasting?
Oh, wow. So, you know, that's a great question. Well, I was talking about Gary earlier on. I had a full circle moment with Gary in that he was always my real role model journalistically. He was amazing, and he loved what people would think were non-stories, and he would make an amazing story out of it. But Gary was always quite a large chap, and then suddenly he lost all this. He lost all this weight. He lost it all. He'd struggled with cancer for most of his life. He was diagnosed with testicular cancer when he was 21, 22. And then, you know, for years it came back and forth. But anyway, but he lost all this weight. And I said, Gary, there's a job going at ITV. And he'd done all sorts. He'd gone all around the country. He was running, you know, huge radio stations in the north of England, like Juice FM in Liverpool, and some big stations, but he just wanted to be on air. He just didn't want to do that anymore. He just wanted to. So he came back, and he was working at BBC Radio Guernsey in Jersey for a bit. So look, there's a job going at Channel. You've got to come and do it. It's like, really? It's like, come and do it. And anyway, so he got a job. He got it, and that was just such a great. We were then peers. Mm-hmm. I never really saw him as a peer. I always kind of put him on a pedestal, but I worked with him for a couple of years. But he was a real huge influence in me from a local journalism perspective. And then after that, you know, there's different people. Because when you're in a hyper local environment, it's you're kind of only as big as your world that you're in, so you don't really look at the big international. And you know, you'd respect people like the Trevor McDonalds and people like that, but there's no one you really kind of go, that's who I want to be. But these days, I love listening to podcasts, and, you know, big fan of Alistair Campbell and Rory Stewart, and, you know, that I think that's taken the medium to a completely, you can really kind of delve into stuff that you're interested in politics. And they're also very good at, you know, there's the other thing, young journalists fall into this trap all the time, they're too embarrassed to say that they don't understand something, so they end up doing a piece that nobody understands because they didn't understand it in the first place. Rory Stewart and Alistair Campbell make no, you know, apologies for completely explaining things down to the absolute basic detail, which is so important. It's a massive part of journalism. That's what we're supposed to do. We're supposed to be the jack of all trades and master of none. That's what we do. We take anything and tell the audience a digestible story. And living in a financial jurisdiction, you can imagine there were some complicated news stories to tell, like liquidation and when the lands banking crisis happened, trying to explain that to viewers and all those things. The Icelandic banks all failed, but in terms of those types of role models, it was just the people I worked with and the people around me. It really were, and I just had a great time for 4 or 5 years. So after that, so that was around 2010, 2011, and I'd just got married in 2010 to my wife Natalie, who's a teacher, primary teacher, and we made the decision to leave Guernsey. It was something that I'd always had an itch to do. I'd always thought. There's a few times I flirted with leaving because I'd had that kind of epiphany when I went to Middlesbrough And Chichester, yeah, wow, it's the big wide world. And I kind of went it alone. Yeah. I did some freelancing. I managed to get a football club to let me go and do streaming. So I was right at the beginning of live streaming. You know, live streaming 14 years ago was a challenge. And I had all these massive satellites and football pitches and stuff like that. And it was just, I was living in Devon at this point near family, and all the work was back here in London. So I was just going back and forth to London from Devon with two kids under two. It was really difficult. Mm-hmm. So, journalists, we have this, I'm sure lots of people at the kind of level I was at would agree with me. You have this moment go, God, I need to actually make some money at some point. So what do I do? Do I go into education? Do I go into to a completely different field? I actually went for an interview at a teaching college and I got turned down, which is ironic now, to teach media studies. I wanted to do that. I was going to go and learn how to be a secondary teacher for media studies, but I got turned down at Truro Teaching College. It was really sobering, and because I'd been an ITV journalist for 5 years, I'd worked in radio, had all this professional experience, and I got turned down to even go and do the course. And that was quite sobering.
So it wasn't just not getting the job because there was somebody else who had whatever qualifications that they deemed right, actually, to even do the course. Yeah, do you think maybe you were overqualified?
I think that was the feedback. They thought I'd get bored. And that because I had a family and all that, they weren't totally sure that I was the right fit for that. And that was quite sobering because, you know, I say it's a term, you know, when you're at your worst, you kind of breathe, you inhale your own exhaust. You know, I was like, well, how could they turn me down? Yeah. Worked for ITV and I've done all these great things and they don't want me to come and teach Cornish kids about media studies. This is ridiculous. So I was, you know, but then I was trying to be as humble as possible. So then I started looking at everything, you know, complete career changes. Just trying and using transferable skills to do something different. And so I was looking and wasn't really getting anywhere. And then this, I was on The Guardian, not The Sunday Guardian, The Guardian, which is, you know, a real one, the place to go for media jobs. I'm not being paid by The Guardian to say that. And there was this thing. Me and my wife referred to it as the Kent thing for a couple of weeks. And it's this, we're looking for this news editor to help launch a TV station, to, you know, it's a connection with, in conjunction with the University of Kent and all these things, and there'll be some education. I was like, I'm totally qualified for this. And I went down each thing. Fact that it was higher education, because I knew that I wanted to get into education as well, so I really did enjoy working with young people. And I just threw the application in. I didn't spend any time on it because I didn't really, you know, think I was going to go back to my wife and say, let's move to Kent. We're living in, you know, beautiful Devon, and we're on the border with Cornwall. And I got a phone call from Tim Luckhurst, who was the professor here, about 20 minutes after I submitted, and said, Andy, you look very interesting. We'd love to have you up for an interview. So I came up for an interview in 2015, and they had made me put this 12-minute bulletin together. And they said, oh, I'd just do national news or whatever. And they'd give me a couple of reporters, and they wanted me to put it together. I said, no, I'm going to make it. So I made it all local. And I got it absolutely timed to 12 minutes. I presented it myself. And Tim was like, thank you very much. That's great. And then I got a phone call the next day. And they offered me the job. Yeah. And, I was like, okay, this is great. But what I found out later was that they had been searching for someone like me for ages. Yeah. Of someone who had this experience. But... you know, still wanted to get stuck in and had the education, and it was just a perfect fit.
And I'm just thinking, we'll wrap up in a moment, but what you said there is really insightful, because you didn't get the Cornish job. My mother's a big believer in this sort of notion of meant to be, you know, and because if you'd got that job in Cornwall, you wouldn't have come to Kent. You wouldn't be doing what you're doing now. Do you look back over what you've done? I mean, what you know, there's the whole question about what your younger self would say to your present self, what you would say to your younger self. But do you kind of feel that sometimes you need those knocks, you need those occasions when things don't go the way you want them to, and you beat yourself up over it, but then you come out of it stronger because you've developed that resilience? It's you know, back to that question that I whetted your appetite with earlier about whether you can be nostalgic about negative experiences. But it sounds like actually the journey for you has been a very positive one, even though along the way there may have been a few bumps in the road.
Oh, there's been some massive challenges. Like, the real kind of turning point was that I was working for this other firm in Devon, and I got stranded on a job, two kids at home. And I couldn't get it. I don't know if you remember it, but there was these really kind of intense air traffic control strikes around 2014, 2015, and I got stuck in Barcelona. It sounds great to most people, but it really wasn't. I was supposed to go for a night. It ended up being four or five nights and they couldn't get us home. And I just remember coming home and talking to my wife. It's like, we can't continue this. So I just walked in and I resigned. That was it. So I can't do this with a house and two young children, no job. And I did really have to have resilience in that moment. But to understand that sometimes you have to make decisions that it's not just about paying bills, but, you know, how to keep your life kind of going. It was, you know, when you describe it to people, they go, wow, that was brave. Yes, it was brave, but it was actually the only thing we could really do, because it was just completely unmanageable for me to be stuck all over the world or going back and forth to London all the time. We just needed to make that change. And like my you know, in the end, like you were saying, my wife and I called it the Kent thing. And we came up and we knew no one, and we stayed. We had this most awful experience when we first came. We went to booked in a Premier Inn near Westmorland, and we were all sick. My daughter was sick on the way up in the car. And then we all got this bug. We were supposed to just come for the weekend to find somewhere to live. And we were just all bawling. I was thinking, what are we doing? What are we doing? And, you know, I'd been offered this other opportunity in Bristol, where all of a lot of her family live. But it was, you know, doing something completely different, like recruiting or something. And we just talked through this opportunity in Kent. And I remember she just said to me, Andy, you've just got to take that. You've got to do it. And I wouldn't have done it had she not said that. I think we probably would. So I suppose to come back to being nostalgic about negative, absolutely. When, you know, I am absolutely nostalgic about those terrible and those challenging times in Middlesbrough. The feeling of being unemployable,
yes,
in Devon and Cornwall, that was really hard for me. When I'd been turned down for that, just to train to be a teacher. It wasn't even a job, it was just to train. It was a real challenge, and it did change what I was going to do. And, you know, we've barely talked about the 9 years that I've been here at KMTV. But all of that just got me into this position to be this hopeful. This is what I want to be. I hope people think that I'm this kind of mentor figure. What Gary was to me, I hope that I am to them, of letting them make mistakes, developing, and then moving them on to something else, and giving them those skills or those opportunities, but most importantly, the employability to go and do plenty of other things. And that's why we've got such a great record at KMTV,
yeah,
of sending people into other opportunities.
Yeah. And I've got one more question which builds on what you've just said about whether you would consider yourself, Andy, to be a looking back or a looking forward kind of person.
I think I... Great question. When I look forwards, right, and I don't know if this at different points in my life, I've definitely been a half full rather than a half empty, right, kind of person. I was explaining this concept to my daughter, talking about Five Guys milkshakes the other day, about whether she would have feel that she had half of her favourite Five Guys milkshake left, or if she was disappointed that she'd had half of it. And she stopped and thought about that, and she wasn't quite sure, but I think she said half empty in the end. She was, oh, well, I probably just want another one. But, you know, she's 11, she would say that. But I've definitely been on either side, and when my mental health is good, it's usually half full, and when it's bad, it's half empty. But I've always worked to worst case scenarios, right? Obviously, the University of Kent is going through a really difficult time. We are owned by the University of Kent. We have, with the journalism school closing, which is deeply upsetting. It's obviously going to call into question what's going to happen with KMTV, given our close relationship with the Centre for Journalism. Whilst that decision was very sad, we know that we're still going to have students for the next 2 years. We're going to have opportunities for the next 2 years to really help people and help journalists and help them get into industry. And that's the way that I think I'm looking at that now. Plus, what I say to anybody, because you know the way the academic world work, we came to you where it's very different. Differently, 2 years in KMTV years is like dog years. It's like 10 years. We can do a lot in 2 years in KMTV. We can do a lot, and we also, you know, have learned that landscapes change as well quickly. In the academic world, it's a little bit different. You know, they like to do things a bit slower. You know, plan for the plan. That's what I kind of find with large institutions. Whereas we kind of adapt to the situation that we're in at the time. So that's, I kind of do live in the moment. That's the way that I feel. When I'm in a good place, I'm living for the moment. I work to worst case scenarios. And, you know, if your worst case scenario isn't that bad, then you just got to be happy. I do like to reminisce and look back. From a professional perspective, I do love looking back at all the great people that we've trained here, and you know, I talk about them all like children, like they've, you know, oh, that was so funny when, you know, Louisa Britton said this, or Josie Hannett said that, or when Joe Coshen did this, or oh, did you see Joe on ITN News at 10 the other night? You know, I love a good analogy, and one that hit me when I got to my kind of mid-20s. And it's a football one, so sorry. But there is at one point that you stop dreaming of playing for England and you dream for your children to play for them instead. Yeah. And that's what I vicariously do with our staff here at KMTV. And that's what I feel I'm most proud of in my job, is that our record is 100% that our full-timers go and do. And I get so proud that they've achieved things that I haven't. You know, they've completely outgrown me. They've, you know, doing stuff on the international and national stage, and it's brilliant. As well as all the proud achievements that I've had here at KMTV, the series that we've done, and all those types of things. The Generation Y that we worked on with you, Chris. You know, why not? Let's do this as our exclusive on your podcast. We're very pleased and excited that Generation Y is going to be on ITVX. You heard it here first. And, you know, that has exceeded all expectations of what we could achieve as a small little TV channel that we end up making national series that are affecting people's lives. It's incredible.
And
it
completely changed my life as well. But that's where this podcast will end. And there's plenty elsewhere on me reflecting on that very thing. But Andy, wonderful and a real privilege to catch up. What a journey. What an odyssey that has been. But
yeah.
Thank you.
There's more to go.
What we can do a part B. Thank you for being my guest this week.
Thank you, Chris.